I'll take a motion.
Suggestion, if nobody wants to do that, then perhaps we should hold a meeting. I don't think these things are live. I don't think we are.
No, we're not.
We're not taping.
Nope.
You still can't tell any off-color jokes yet.
That's right.
Anybody and everybody, hopefully, has read the minutes. Anybody wish to make corrections, subtractions, or additions? I would take a motion if anybody was so inclined.
I move we approve as presented.
Second?
Second.
Moved and seconded. Everybody in favor?
Aye.
Okay. So we're going to talk about the ambulance services, what we've heard, what we want to do about it. I'd like Kelly to talk about what she thinks we're expecting out of this meeting. But to me, where we're headed now is starting to set up concluding steps. We're going to take a break here for the rest of December, readjourn in January. As we come back together in January, we should be looking to what recommendations we're going to make to the council, what we want the council to do with those recommendations. If we have information that we would like staff to compile in one way or another, we can direct staff to do that. They will have the rest of this month to get ready for whatever that looks like next month. Obviously, ambulance service is the star attraction at this point in time, but we still have central services to conclude, and we have ComDev to look at before we start getting into the nitty-gritty of what recommendations we might make for cost containment, reduction, etc. We have promised some time in January to the Fire Department Union, Firefighters Union. Brent will come. He told me that he only needs about 2.5-3 hours worth of presentation on the next meeting, and would expect questions of that length. We're going to give him some time on the next agenda, not to be too funny with it, but so that will develop as well. Kelly?
Yes, so why, before we move into the information that Bren has and the information that Chief Shepherd provided, maybe we can talk a little bit about the timeline. We're not going to have a meeting. This is our only meeting in December. We won't be having a meeting on the 18th. But we have because the first meeting would normally be on New Year's Day, and I didn't think you guys wanted to come on New Year's Day, but if you really do, you can do it.
I was going to say, you do not have to necessarily skip the 18th. You could have a meeting on the 18th.
I won't be here. I think it would be better if we didn't.
Oh, darn.
You know, people go on vacation, and I think people are... No, I would rather us not. And we kind of factored that in when we looked at the calendar until February. So we have two dates in January. Bring one of those.
So right now, the 15th is scheduled, but we're proposing the 8th and the 22nd instead, the 7th and the 4th.
I would like to get it off of council rotation. This being the third meeting in a row, not that this isn't just a nice, light, friendly group, but...
Bryn, if we did the second...
The 8th?
The 2nd,
no.
Sorry.
No, go ahead.
The 8th is what Dennis is saying.
Right.
No go. So if you wanted to do the 15th and the 22nd, or the 15th and the 29th,
what was the wrong with the 8th and the 22nd?
The 8th, I believe you said you didn't want because it's a...
No, I do like it.
Oh, you do,
I
do like it?
I do like it.
You like
I would really like it if we could get it off of the same week as council. Maybe Steph would think differently, but three meetings in a row. The 8th is not a council meeting.
The council meeting is on the 7th.
Yes. There is?
Yeah, because it's the first Tuesday.
Oh, crap.
So would you want to do the 15th and the 29th?
Yeah. It just is a bit much in council week.
I get that. So do you all know your calendar well enough that the 15th and the 29th would work for you?
Make it work.
I will not be here, but...
See, I already have it on the 15th.
Yeah, we already had
15th. We did have one scheduled for the 15th.
Okay, then the 29th.
So we add the 29th.
I was going to say, I must be like psychic or something.
January.
If I could just January 29th?
Yep.
Is that what we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And so let's talk a little bit about that schedule. So today, you know, we have a little bit more on the ambulance, not much, unless you have more questions. We have central services. I don't think we have very much, except maybe if you all had some questions. At the last meeting, we talked a little bit about, Councilor Seppinger brought up some things that she wanted us to look at, and Pam called me and asked me for a couple of things that she wanted to look at. And they are around our expenditures. They're around our expenditures in the general fund that are related to essential services versus value services. And I can speak a little bit to that and what the council did last year regarding those things. And then there was a question about the water treatment plant and looking at LEED certification, so we have some information on that too. So we have that. I think that might fill up today. I think actually we have a good discussion on our more discretionary general fund dollars. And then moving into the 15th and the 29th, I think ComDev is probably going to take a meeting. It's pretty beefy in terms of what community development does, their functions. If you were looking at cutting what would that look like? Can anyone else do those functions, those kinds of things, and what that might look like? And we've done a little bit of work on that already, but we would need to do more. So I think we could do that.
Do you think you could combine them with the firemen's union? Do you need half an hour? Is that too little? Let's negotiate.
We also haven't put much time in to present it, putting all the work together yet. I wouldn't think more than
45
minutes.
At least start the balance of it with, for the interest of time, so if we can get that and ComDev at least started.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if we need ComDev to come back, well, maybe we have ComDev come back.
Yeah. So then on the 29th, we could have, if ComDev needed to wrap up, and then I think from us presenting information, like this kind of educational effort that this is, and then kind of making some recommendations, I think we would probably be done with all the kind of the factual information that we've provided. And I think then we could start, this group could start talking about recommendations. I think you could focus, and Brent and I talked about this today, about helping you maybe with a list of questions that you might think would be appropriate to ask, or how to think about making your recommendations about things like the ambulance service, fire district possibly, things with ComDev, things with our value services versus essential services discussion, that discussion. So I think that could easily take up a meeting on the 29th. And then if need be, we could have a meeting in February and get it all kind of wrapped up. Because what I would like to do is, when you are wrapping things up, I would like to bring something back to you so you can look at it before it goes to the city council. I think that feels, comfortable to me, so I'm not just taking your words and then writing them up and then taking them to council.
Can I ask a question? So are you saying that you're going to come back with ideas as well to cut or to reduce? Is that what you're saying?
We can come. I think what I'd like to do from the information that we provided is get ideas from you on things you would like us to look at in more detail, and then us go and look at them in more detail.
If kind of addressing that, if we take a look at our last meeting being a meeting where we would approve whatever it is we've come up with, whenever that is, and you work backwards. I think what Kelly's saying is that the meeting before the last one, she would bring back to us what she's heard from us mm-hmm. at this point, the input that we've had. We'll examine that, okay. Add to it, subtract from it, or whatever, amend it, and then she'll bring that back again for final review, something along those lines. Mm-hmm. And that looks like it would be somewhere the first meeting, the second meeting in February. We might need two meetings in February, I don't know, in order for you to be able to accomplish that. Because not only, I think it's good if staff brings back some recommendations, mm-hmm. but I think this group is going to have some recommendations, and that's all got to get put together into something that we approve and discuss, which mm-hmm. is going to be one full meeting, I would think, or at least the subject of a meeting. Mm-hmm. Other thoughts? Does that work?
I was just kind of thinking out loud. I mean, it's on my second meeting, and going over the minutes, other than one audio, I'm trying to fill in the gaps. Yeah. Right. So what I guess I was getting at was, the committee is going to come up with what they're thinking about, but I don't want to say you know where all the skeletons are, but you probably know where all the skeletons are. So, you know, as far as facilitating the process, it would seem to me to be easier or a hybrid kind of setup where you come back and say, hey, if the goal is to achieve X, then this is what we would do in order to achieve X. I mean, it's just kind of my... Does that make sense?
And I can certainly do that. I will tell you how I will do it, just so you all know, is the council, before the last biennium budget, did an abbreviated, and I would call it goal setting, I wouldn't call it strategic planning, but I think they did some prioritization for the budget, and that's what I'm going to look at. So when I look at these skeletons, if you will, I'm going to look at where they lie in terms of that bifurcation of essential services and what the council kind of considered value services. So it probably won't come as a surprise that if I'm looking at making recommendations on reductions, it's probably going to be in the value services because the council's priority was to maintain and keep whole as much as possible essential services. So I just wanted to tell you the kind of my methodology.
What I would like to see us do, subject to agreement, is if we can get any kind of projection of what the general fund is going to be in the next biennium. Mm-hmm. How many dollars is it going to be? We should be able to project that. And what we're going to do with that distinct pot of money is part of what we're charged with doing here. And what I think is going to be the interest of at least most of us here is how do we make a meaningful impact on the idea of the square peg in the round hole? How do we make this fit? And what's the best pathway to that? You look as if you're...
Well, yeah, you're talking the language I'm thinking. I just will very much need to be talking numbers, because this is how I think. And I think we're getting a lot of concepts, a lot of ideas, but it, so far right. I don't have numbers in my head, anything right. we've talked about.
Right.
And that's a big gap for me coming up with a solution.
Mm-hmm. No, and I think that's fair. I think with the ambulance service, I do think, and we can go over sort of those numbers, I think today we're going to have some pretty, I think, some good numbers for you when we talk about those things in the general fund that might be characterized as being more value services and those numbers. But you're right, what you don't have is how much is city government going to cost and how much revenue do you think you're going to have and what's the difference between those two? And you don't have that yet. You're right. So we'll work on that as well.
I'm not sure that we have total agreement yet with regard to what our value services in the general budget in terms of things like I looked at the goals that we did in the council, and it had things like serve as a value service from what I could see. So I think it's important at some point that we identify what in here is a value service and what in here is a central service.
Which is a council issue, not for us, right?
It's, well, we can do it by way of recommendation.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. I mean, you could, we could be saying these are the things that we see okay. in our deliberations, if that's fair.
And my other thought was that I personally like to see a little more than the next biennium, maybe a 5-6 year plan, understanding that the out numbers aren't as accurate. Because looking at, and I'll just repeat myself here from the last meeting, this ambulance decision is very strategic and it would play out over many years. So rather than just one or two biennium, it'd be nice to see how that would affect cities' sustainability out farther than just the next biennium.
I think, though, just and I agree, but I think if we can, I think we have a challenging enough environment over the next biennium that once you have that, you do put in place future biennials. But I think we can work on this side. Is there Mike?
One more little comment, which is I'm hearing at least two meetings in February just to do this right. So if we could get those on the calendar before we quit today, just tentative. So we can.
No, I think we just sort of specked that out, didn't we? If everybody's
so
in agreement.
Since we're going to try to do not council right. weeks, it would be the February, it would be February 12th and February 26th. Hopefully we could wrap it.
26 is the problem. I'm out of time.
Could you want to do the 12th and the 19th?
Sure. If we need to, we back to that. Can everybody do that? I'm sorry. I just realized, I just know that I just made reservations. It's Sanders birthday. Come on. I got to take it someplace. Come on.
Will the 19th work?
I don't know. I'm gone a week in February, but I can't remember what week, and I don't know my calendar.
Okay. Why don't you let us know? But let's tentatively schedule that for the 12th and the 19th.
It seems like those last two, 1 week apart, is actually good because we should be done asking for data. But right. We have to be done.
We really do. This wasn't a life sentence. Mike?
So I want to go back. You were saying the council defined essential services. And Steph said it wasn't defined, so the question that came up, are we defining what's essential? Or are we making recommendations to what's essential?
No, we did define essential and value services. I think Steph is talking about within the general fund, we're not really honed it down that much, which is what Kelly's point is. I think we've done some first step prioritization, first step strategic planning, if you want to call it that. Really, a lot more has to be done. We'll see how we get there. But I think Steph is, and I don't mean to be talking for you, but I think we're looking for agreement on what is essential and what is a value service. at least for the discussion of the general fund.
There are a number of things that we've funded, such as the social service grants, that are...
She's been very consistent on this.
Right?
Yep. That's a compliment. That's
well, I think that because we have a committee that's going to look at added value services and funding of those, they have to look at the things that are actually added value services like that, as opposed to just leaving it in the general fund, which is what we've been doing. If we're really looking at trying to say what an essential service is. I mean, there are a lot of things that we do that are really cool, but they're not essential. And in our budget process, we may not be able to do that.
Well, and I think we actually, I think we can talk about that with the information that Bryn's provided. It's going to kind of, the way it's presented, it's going to sort of beg the question in a way for you to say, okay, well, let's look at these things, these what I would consider more discretionary pots of money of the general fund, because those pots of money can be spent a lot of different ways. They're not dedicated to one thing. Those social service grants, for example, or the economic grants that are not restricted, or some other things that we have, the marijuana tax money. And it's not a huge amount of money, and it's not a huge... number of things, but they are things that I think you had asked us to look at, and we got some data for you and some numbers. So how about, I think I have a good idea of sort of our calendar.
Okay.
And what it's going to look like, and we can kind of put that together and get that to you so everyone is, we're all on the same page.
That would be great.
And so with that, how about if we go into, we kind of continue the ambulance services discussion a little bit.
I just want to check. Was there any other comments on for the good of the process while we were on this?
No.
You're very quiet.
Just, I mean, and I think we're talking about it. The sort of like a scalpel approach, like we can look at a lot of different things. We don't necessarily have to go for a hacksaw and
right.
get $500,000 from ambulance or whatever.
Right.
And being able to do that with the help of the analysis that staff is providing. And then potentially recommendations from staff as well.
I guess where I'm coming from with that is the money that we have to create have to be out of ambulance service?
No.
Are the three firemen essential service, or are they really value service? Maybe they're really essential service. I want to be sure that we're not just only looking at ambulance service as a way of...
I agree.
You don't have to budget.
It's a really good point. We don't know yet. And really, the decision isn't ours to decide where it eventually comes from. Ours is to make the recommendation of a range of things that can be looked at. So you don't put the pressure on ourselves to have to make that decision. Ours is to say, here's these buckets of funding, the pros and cons. And we might make recommendations on what we think are the priorities within that. And staff helping us along the way. I mean, I think one of the things that comes to mind when I think of this over this effort that I would encourage, and Kelly and I have talked a bit about this, administration, department heads, everybody that's involved, there's two ways that this is going to play out in the future. One is going to be if we can plan proactively how to live within a certain framework, whether there are revenue additions to be made or not is somewhat sitting off the side. But we have to proactively figure out how to do that. Or the alternative to that is you are going to have it somewhat foisted upon you at some point in the future. You're going to have it forced upon you because of market conditions, because of changing of council, because of changing of budget committee, because of changing attitudes, which are already somewhat there in the community. So this is an opportunity, and I encourage staff to take this opportunity as well as for us to help them take this opportunity and to figure out how to fit this in a better way than we have in the past. We just have to figure that out without constantly increasing taxes and fees that have become a highly sensitive issue. So something like that.
Well, and I think for this group, what from a staff perspective I'm looking at presenting you information that is about funding and services. And so I may be able to say to you, well, we can cut these programs or reduce these programs or do those things, and that is going to come with a super service reduction, and that's what this looks like. And then it's a policy decision on how palatable that is. I'll give you an example with the marijuana money. Mark, when he was the administrative services director, made a recommendation that the marijuana money all come into the general fund. And what the council, what the budget committee experienced was a bunch of community members coming and saying, no, we can't have that. We need that money for affordable housing. And so that's from a staff perspective what I'm looking at. And I totally agree that we need to have a long-term financial sustainability plan that everyone understands what it looks like. Does it look like more revenue or less service, or does it look like a combination of both that is palatable to the community? And so I think what I will be, in part, what I'll be bringing back to you too with recommendations are different ways to look at these services, and maybe different ways to look at funding some of these services as opposed to the way they're funded now.
And I think to Roberta's point, that's where, and I think we're probably all about in that situation where we need to see numbers. What size are we talking about, and what are the options?
Yeah.
Okay.
So I guess the problem I have with that is you're assuming that these services right now are 100% efficient, and that if you cut anything, the services get cut back. And I would question whether we aren't supposed to look at anything beside that. I would wonder if there are things we could do to make it more efficient to provide the same service.
I don't disagree.
But we don't. That's something I haven't seen since.
We've had that. We've had those discussions. I mean, this is the discussion. This is. Although I want to say, this is the discussion where you have that dividing line between oversight and micromanagement. We need to have, and when I say that department heads and departments need to figure out how to do what Mike is talking about here, which is become more efficient, this is what we're asking the internal effort to be. But it's not ours to say to Kelly or the chief, this job should only take X number of hours. So there's got to be.
But what
you say, make it more efficient.
No, what I just heard was that if we cut money, we're going to cut services, and I saw it before. Well, we need to cut comdev, so we cut code enforcement. Okay. And so you cut a position. The question is, the rest of ComDev, does it get looked at? Just as an example. Or is it just, we just pick a position and cut it? And
No, I think, Mike wasn't here when that position got eliminated, but my guess is the director of community development looked at the department and said, what are the essential functions of this department and what aren't? And we're going to cut a non-essential function. That's what my a non-essential program, that is, I guess.
Here's what I would say about that. And then maybe we need to go. I mean, your point is well taken. But it's a very good example of you can either figure out how to make things more efficient and come back with a plan that says we're going to make this more efficient, or a budget committee is going to cut positions. Mm-hmm. These are the two dynamics. Mm-hmm. And so what we're trying to do is somewhat get ahead of this,
right. This
over here that happens in about a year and a half that says that you're going to face and people are going to say cut. If you want to avoid the cutting, you need to come in with a plan that is well thought out, made more efficient, might look like we're going to spend less money, but is not a cut, which is what you're saying. There's not just one way of getting to spending less money. One of those is to cut. The other one is to make more efficient. And so that's part of what our charge is as we segue out of information gathering into a discussion that gives recommendations to staff that then all of us will give recommendations to the council, and hopefully we take those forward and do something with them by way of policy. Something along those lines. So, perhaps we should go to your presentation for the day. And I don't want to cut, but it's just that,
yeah.
Are you satisfied for the moment?
For the moment.
Okay. And as always, I mean, if we have more thoughts, feed them to Kelly. And, I mean, I don't mind meeting all throughout next year. I kind of like this group. It's had some of the best conversations that I've had around numbers and budgets since I've been involved. I think it's been a really interesting process. So go ahead. Take us where you want us to go.
Okay. So at the last meeting, one of the things that you asked Chief Shepherd for is the standards of coverage, which you got a copy of that was emailed to you, and the annual ambulance service report, which kind of talks about our staffing, talks about our notification and our response times and those kinds of things. And so I had asked, the standards of coverage is about a 40-page document, and so I asked Chief Shepherd to come and just kind of summarize this for you, kind of hit the highlights, and then hit the highlights of the annual ambulance service report as well. What I don't remember from last time is if you asked for that for Mercy Flights as well. And I didn't think you did, because we got you exactly what you asked for, but I don't know, after you hear this and see this, if you want Mercy Flights to provide the same thing.
I think what we were looking for, if I remember correctly, is the standards by which we have been budgeting for, that have been governing things.
Mm-hmm. And that would be this.
Till now. So that, I mean.
So to add on that, would that mean that, you know, an A, B, C, D, and E would be defined similarly to how Mercy Flights were defined?
The calls, yeah.
An A, B, I think that's kind of what I was looking for.
Okay. Well, I'd let Chief Shepherd answer that. I think I know the answer, but I'll let you. You're the expert in that, you know, if that's the case.
Real quick, the 2018 annual ambulance service report. This is it's compiled by the county, by Jackson County. And it involves input from both Jackson Fire and Rescue, Mercy Flights, and Rogue River. So the three ASAs within Jackson County. Towards the end of the year, Jackson County asked us to submit a bunch of detailed information, and much of that information gets put into this document, and then this document gets sent out to all the agencies, you know, all the EMS providers in the area. Everybody has a very public document that everybody can and Jackson County has the opportunity to look at. And I think it was just, it came up at some point during that last meeting. Somebody was asking about it, and so here it is. Please look through it. There's not, it's kind of nice that it really shows you the comparison between the three ASAs, between Rose River, Mercy Flats, and Ashland. You can kind of look at the number of units we have out, the number of calls we're responding to, give you some indication of the about response time requirements, how each of the agencies is doing in regards to the reporting information. So, that's that document. Now, Sean, in regards to like how we respond to calls, each agency is going to respond somewhat differently, but we're all probably pretty much the same. When we're talking about medical emergencies, it's usually an ambulance with, an EMT and a paramedic or two paramedics here in Ashland. And then as the acuity of the call, as the patient status becomes more critical, then we start adding on more people. Fairly straightforward. What I want to say, the standards of coverage was developed in 2009 by our interim fire chief, Larry Langston. Larry has been a long time fire chief up in the Bend area, both in Anchorage and in Bend. Had done standards of coverage documents for both of those departments when he was there. And he ended up, after just 6 months as an interim with us, he went back to Bend and continued to work for them for a number of years and just recently retired. So when he came to Ashland, he realized that we have never done this type of a study. We had never put it in paper to give to the council to say, look, this is what we're capable of doing. So really, for the most part with this document, I would highly encourage you, if you haven't yet, is to read the introduction, which is on page 2, read the conclusion, which is on the last page. That kind of explains why this document was put together. And it's basically a risk analysis. It says, this is what we are able to accomplish at this point in time. If you don't think it's enough, maybe we should talk about doing more. If you think it's adequate, great. Or if you think it's too much, like I think we don't need to be achieving these levels, then it gives you a means to communicate back to the fire department about, hey, as policymakers and as a fire department, let's talk about where we're currently at. Well, obviously, a report that was put together in 2009 is a little out of date, and it could certainly be something that we would look at doing here sometime in the near future, but it's fairly time consuming. In light of current talks, I think it would be nice to get something in place maybe before the next budget cycle begins, so that the budget committee and the council has some sort of a document that's up to date. But read the intro, read the conclusion, and then once you've read those, refer to pages 26 and 27, because that's probably, when I think about the majority of the actual fire calls that the fire department has to respond to, a moderate risk structure fire that's outlined on page 26, it shows you a diagram of the number of personnel that we feel, at least in 2009, that we felt what we needed to fight just a normal house fire, an everyday house fire, nothing more, nothing less. It shows the positions that are needed. And then that's on page 26. And on page 27, we refer to what the NFPA recommends. And that's what the conclusion talks about. We use National Fire Protection Agency as this document. And it says, if you want to be, we feel that most fire departments should do X. And that's something that we've always tried to achieve. And, we haven't quite gotten there yet, but that's always been our goal. Let's try to do what the national organization has said is a standard. But the great thing about a standards of coverage document is that it's designed to be specific for your community. And so in 2009, we said, you know, we're never going to meet the 14 firefighters on scene, you know, within 8 minutes. We're never going to meet that, not at our current staff level. And we're probably, we always are going to have to include our mutual aid partners in Fire District 5. We're going to have to count them as part of our group. So knowing that we're never going to meet that 14 firefighters on scene standard, what is it that we hope to achieve? And so, and we outline that in here. In 2009, we decided, Larry figured that, hey, if we can get on scene with 12 firefighters, we can do all the basic functions that need to get done. And that kind of worked in with our current, with that staffing level that we had at that time, with the addition of the District 5 firefighters. Anyway, just any questions on these documents? I don't know if you had a chance to look through them and put them in. If at the next meeting you have questions about these, I'd be more than happy to answer them for you. You can email them.
One question, just very specific equipment question. Can you describe the difference between the Type 1, 2, and 3 ambulances?
Yes, I can. So looking at the ambulance service report
on page 5.
On page 5, it gives you a breakdown of the types of rigs. So, a Type 1 is a truck chassis. It has a box attached to the Type. So that's, we, you know, our kind of square looking, very large ambulances are Type 1. Type 2s are a van type rescue. So it's actually a van that's been converted into a rescue. And then the Type 3, I believe, is a van chassis with a box built onto the back. So just slightly different style of ambulances.
Is there a great cost difference in each one of those?
There is, yeah. I think in one of my papers I sent to you, we talked a little bit about that. Our Type 1s are approaching $230,000, $240,000. It's my understanding, talking to a couple different manufacturers, that the smaller Type 2 vans will probably half that cost fully outfitted.
What about threes?
I'm not sure about threes.
Would you think they would be less expensive? Or you don't
know? No, I think they'll be somewhere in between a Type 1 and a Type 2.
What's the service line difference between the two?
You know, I have no experience with the van types, so I'm not really sure. I mean, we could maybe ask that. Who runs Type 2s? How long does a Type 2 ambulance usually last?
It depends on really your agency policy of how long you're going to hold on to the ambulance or cycle those ambulances through. At Mercy Flakes, we usually take them about to 200,000 miles. We cycle them out every about 7 to 8 years. The ambulances we particularly use have diesel engines in them. They're Mercedes diesel engines. So, you know, if you use that versus, say, a Ford type vehicle with a gas engine, there's going to be differences there in terms of lifespan and that kind of thing. But ours do, our Type 2 Mercedes do really well for that 200,000.
When you talk about, you know, Jim, we've talked internally within the department, and it kind of comes back to what you guys are talking about, efficiency within the department. We only have X amount of dollars, so I can be more efficient. So, you know, we've talked about looking at the Type 2s. Our biggest thing is we have to get around the fact that as a fire department / ambulance service, we require our firefighters, our medics, to carry all of their gear, their firefighting equipment with them. And it takes up the turnout gear. Our equipment that we have to carry with us takes up a lot of room. And so we struggle a little bit with how could we work out of a Type 2 ambulance and have all of our firefighting equipment with us. Not to say that we couldn't overcome that. I'm sure we could come up with something. Maybe we have to actually carry the gear on the fire engine, and then just when the crew arrives on scene, they have to get changed at that point in time. things like that. But we will be looking at it.
So ours are all all-wheel drive?
Yeah, four-wheel drive.
Okay.
Capable. And we also, because ours are a truck chassis with this specific, you know, with this special built box, mm-hmm. the ambulance that goes on the back, we're also going to start looking at can we take some of these boxes that have held up well over the years and actually just transfer them onto another chassis. So all we're having to do is just buy the drivetrain for the ambulance, not the ambulance box itself. And that would probably come with those substantial savings.
So right now we replace the entire thing and
yes.
equipment and all?
Yep.
Really?
Not the expensive durable equipment that gets moved from one ambulance to the next. So things like the gurney, the defibrillator, but all the smaller equipment within the vehicle, those get you buy it new each every couple of years, every 3 years.
Sure. Yeah, this one goes back to the firefighting. And I asked this of Chief Carnes.
Okay.
If we mandated fire sprinklers?
Yep.
Would that cut staffing at all? I didn't see that in the chart.
Yeah. Well, that's an extremely progressive thought. But my personal opinion, if you require every building in the city of Ashland to be sprinkled, all right? Every building is sprinkled. So that way I know that, and we're maintaining the sprinkler system. So when a building catches on fire, I know that 99.9% of the time the sprinklers are going to put that fire out. You could have a dramatically smaller fire department. Basically, you would have a water cleanup slash put out the remnants of the fire crew. I mean, because if we've sprinklered every building in town, you could do something different. You might still have to consider what happens when we have a wildland fire. How many people do we need for that? So
there's no rumor to the fact that Mike's thinking about starting a sprinkler.
He will if that's mandated.
I will too. Yeah.
No one will be afford to live here.
It just, you know, that would be it would be an interesting proposition to, you know, get the citizens of, you know, every home that has to be sprinkled. But it is, I mean, that would be one thing that could curb increases in fire department staffing levels. It definitely could. If we can make sure that we're covering the wildland bases.
Sean?
So, Chief, I apologize. You may have answered these questions. I have a couple questions and kind of mishmashed with what's just been asked. But so, type 1 ambulance, you said about $250,000 each, right?
Sure.
Okay, so how much equipment is an addition stuck into every ambulance ready to go? Give me I'm looking for a number. How much plus that 250 is one vehicle? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Rough idea.
50,000.
Okay, so we're talking $300,000 per ambulance. How many ambulances do we have?
Five.
So that's 1.5 million.
Correct.
And how often is that inventory turned over?
Roughly every 3 years.
Okay, so do we own those ambulances outright?
Yes.
Okay. So if Mercy Flight, what would we do if Mercy Flights, if the decision by the council was to move that, would that all disappear and we'd have a 1.5%, 1.5 million recovery? We wouldn't obviously get it all back, but would that be? I'm just asking general bare bones questions here.
A lot of factors. I think at one of my original during my original presentation, I brought up the fact that when Ashland Fire and Rescue took over Ashland Life Support, when we became the ambulance provider, we purchased the ambulance service from
right.
Ashland Life
Yep.
That included some capital, included some land, a building, and the ambulances that they had at the time. But we paid $500,000 for that. So I did throw out that if you're talking about giving up the ambulance service, it might be appropriate to think about selling the ambulance service.
Right. Okay. So what does it cost to maintain an ambulance per year? Rough number. So where I'm going with this, I'm trying to find a number, right? So if we talk about an ambulance, it's 250, it's 50, plus how much for the people to maintain it, the maintenance, the tires, the studded tires, all that stuff.
And all those factors were in the first handout that I gave that talked about the actual cost of the ambulance service.
Okay, well, I looked at that. Maybe I missed that particular.
Sorry.
So you replace one every 3 years?
Correct.
Because some of them are older. Which one?
Oh,
from that.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sometimes we have, because it's not always based upon the year.
It's on mileage.
Thank you. Sometimes a vehicle, you get one, it's a limit. It just doesn't work as well. And so we'll have an older vehicle that maybe we haven't put as many miles on because it got two reserves.
How many miles are we talking about? Just to get an idea.
Anywhere from 600 miles to 160,000 miles.
And you have two older ones that are less than 160.
Yep.
In that chart. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's what, a lot of times you end up, you'll cycle a rig through over a 6 year or 9 year period. It's still in pretty good shape, and it becomes a reserve unit, so it doesn't get used as often. And it's those first and second out units that are getting used every day that are having to run up to Mount Ashland that are really getting beat up by that. Those have to get replaced. So the newer units are getting replaced while the older units, they're still in good shape. The shops still say that the engines work well, the bodies are still intact, nothing's, things aren't falling apart yet. And so
I think Mike was, it sounded almost like you turned over all the ambulances every 3 years.
Yeah,
you mean you have a rotational.
Yes.
You replace one.
We replace three times every 3 years. I'm sorry.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. That was the question.
It's, it's $250,000 every 3 years.
Yeah.
You got more?
I do. One, and this may be, again, I apologize if I'm covering ground that's already been covered, but calls. So what I'm trying to do is be able to compare apples and apples. So I'm looking at AFR, and I'm looking at Mercy Flights, and I want to be able to understand, what I'm comparing. So when I look at the information on calls, so I came up, and so what Ashland is responsible for is roughly, according to 2018 data, 4,065 calls.
Okay.
Is that accurate? Okay. So what I'm trying to understand is non-life-threatening AB type calls. I know 40%, if I'm not mistaken, of those calls would be roughly what we'd classify or what you'd classify as, and I'm going to speak for you, but AB calls. Is that about right?
Yeah, that's good, Sean.
So we can kind of agree that we're talking roughly 1,600 calls a year would be what
C and D.
Yeah, would be the other 20 whatever 2,300.
40% of 4,000 would be 2,800, wouldn't it?
1,600.
I'm sorry.
Wait a minute. Do I teach accounting or you?
No. Sorry.
So 1,600. would be AB.
I just wanted to test you.
No, you did. Yeah. You did. You got me thinking there. What? Is that?
Yes.
Okay. Cool. All right. So I'm just trying to understand that. So if we were comparing apples and apples, we'd be saying that 40% of the calls here in town would be the equivalent of an AB call.
Correct.
Is that fair? Okay. Thank you.
Yeah, it's probably in the 45 to 55% range.
So. It's higher than that.
It could be.
Wow. Depending on what?
Just depending on the data. Because I think when I pull the data, as it currently stands, I'm not actually able to pull what we don't classify within our report management system in Alpha, Bravo, Charlie, Delta, Echo. That's something that dispatch collect. They collect that information. They might be able to tell us how many we respond to. What we collect is it emergent or non-emergent?
Okay, right.
So
okay,
And, you know, and we talked about what the chief talked about in the last meeting is that, you know, there are some, like, some vehicles that are non-emergent, but some vehicles are emergent.
Right.
So it depends where you draw.
Yeah, this, he's, I think they said that, you know, what is an acceptable level of, or standard of, what do you say, of standard of cover, I think was the terminology, right?
It was actually, yeah, it was that question that kind of brought up me bringing this older document to you, talking about that acceptable level of risk. What is standard of cover?
Okay.
What is your standard of cover? You know, what has your community decided that is an acceptable level?
Okay, so it could be 1,600 to 2,000, roughly, would be fair.
That would be fair.
Okay, cool.
I think, yeah, and part of that is, I just want to point out that when we talk about the types of calls we go on, especially from the ambulance service side, in Ashland, we have determined that certain types of calls, like, you know, every call is going to get the ambulance, but only certain types of calls will get the engine response. We'll get those extra personnel, you know, we'll get some more people mobilized. And we base those not upon the A, B, C, or D designation or ECHO designation. We base it upon the type of, like, what it comes in as. Is it a cardiac arrest?
Right.
Is it a seizure? Is it a stroke? Is it childbirth complications? Is it a drown? You know, we have our list, and crew members are basically made aware that, you know, Chief Jeffrey said, if you hear this come in, not only is the ambulance responding, but the fire engine is also responding. So we don't even use the ABCDE system. Now, we might get there.
We're okay.
Not, you know, the fire chiefs would like to get to a system where our call, you know, those vehicles respond based upon those levels. But as it currently stands, each department is allowed to set their own standard.
Different risk tolerance is what they said, right?
So
you're open to the possibility that based on either it's a council decision or a community decision, but there that level of risk tolerance acceptance is something that is moving kind of folks,
Absolutely. I mean, as a fire chief, my job is to enact the policies that council and groups like you are responsible. You know, you tell me what the acceptable level of risk is.
Right.
And I'll tell you if I'm able to get there, and if I'm not able to get there, I'll tell you what I need. But, as your fire chief, as your current fire chief, I'm more than welcome to have a discussion with you about what is an acceptable level of risk.
Right.
To piggyback on that, a question that I've been wanting to ask you, and as I was looking at your document here, it comes to mind, because what we talk about is minimum standards when you're fighting a fire. In other words, when we're busy, we have plans for when we're busy. Part of the, you can correct me and you can say, I'll talk to you next time about this, but part of what I want to have get my hands around is the other side of that coin. Part of the reason that I understand that the reasoning we want both an ambulance and a fire department is because we gain a benefit by keeping firefighters who would be otherwise, without the ambulance service, would be otherwise less active.
Washing vehicles,
whatever that would be. Am I about right?
You are.
On that?
Yeah, okay. I think.
So my question goes somewhere along this line. If you don't have an ambulance service, what are the things we could do with a fire department that would give value to the community? Does that make sense as a question? Because it doesn't have to be, in other words, do you have to keep firefighters busy by using them as ambulance?
A lot comes back to when I identified that if we didn't have the ambulance service, that we go from 4,200 calls to 2,800 calls. So we still have 2,800 calls that we're going to respond to. Now that's assuming that I've told you that if we didn't have the ambulance service, we're still going to send an engine to every medical call, similar to what District 5 and District 3 do. But that would be my recommendation, at least initially. You know, we stopped running the ambulance service, at least initially. Every time we have a medical call in town, we're gonna run on that call. So we're still gonna be fairly busy running on calls. We're gonna lose a third of our call volume. So then it becomes, okay, you've lost a third of your call volume, you definitely have more time. What are you gonna do? Well, the other thing we talked about was reducing the 3 firefighters. So we have less people on shift every day. So that takes away, there's a chunk of our time that's gone, because less people, that means the workload that needs to get done every day is going to be distributed amongst fewer people. But then, you know, just off the top of my head, some of the things, and I'm sure Brent would love to chime in because he's always telling me that they don't have enough time to get everything done, but some of the things that aren't getting done, we're not getting our inspections done like they need to get done. Just because,
that would be my question.
Yeah. So we're, you know, they're too busy doing required training that must be done, running on calls, doing the maintenance around the station, doing the maintenance on the vehicles, and then when they have that couple hours left, it's like, all right, let's go out and do inspections, you know, or really they needed 6 hours to do inspections on one day, and they only end up with 1 hour to do inspections. And so I just had our fire marshal just ran the numbers for me to see where we're at for the year since we're coming in the year, and we're woefully behind. So,
by the way, the 2,800 that you just cited—that's the number that I gave Sean, but he wanted to toss it out because he wanted the 1,600 number. No, I'm just saying.
So
2,800 is the number of calls we would still have to go to, regardless of who does the ambulance service.
That's every 911 call that came in within the city of, just within the city limits in 2018 was 2,800. And then expect that to go down. So, and then real quick, so back to that. If we didn't have the ambulance service, then I would expect that my crews would have some more time so that we would be hitting all of our inspections every year. That was something that would be getting done.
When you go and answer those calls, would you perform services? I mean, what would you do when you got there if you weren't the ambulance?
So kind of comes back to that. You know, 911 call comes in, or the 911 call, first responders, ambulance, transport to the hospital. So we'll be that, we're that first responder level. So if you fall down and break your leg, we're going to show up within 4 minutes, most likely 4 to 6 minutes, and we're going to mobilize your leg, we're going to start an IV, and we're going to give you pain medication, we're going to put a splint on your leg, and then at some point, the ambulance is going to show up. They're going to put you in the back of the ambulance and take you to the hospital. But we're providing that initial care.
Well, that's interesting. Then the community really won't feel it. Unless they're being transported, they won't feel the change. Because it's only in, you're going to be there, you're going to take care of them, and you'll probably get there first or whatever. And the only difference will be someone else is driving them to the hospital if they need to go.
Yeah, and I don't know if you don't remember, Roberta, but I think one of my presentations, I talked about by us having the ambulance service, we're finishing the job. We're just taking that last
step. And finishing means transport.
Yes.
Awesome. That's interesting. With quite a saving by cutting that little segment out, it sounds like, because of the cost of these vehicles.
There's not a huge savings, but there would be a savings.
Hmm. Well, and I want to bring that back. I mean, Chief Shepherd did provide information if you wanted to look at the numbers in terms of if we didn't run the ambulance, finishing that job brings in about $1.2 million a year. So it brings in revenue fish in that job. Yeah. So when you talk about...
But doing that job brings in nothing. Is that correct? Getting there, all that brings in nothing. It's just the transport that brings in.
That's right. That's the only thing that can be charged.
Okay.
So those transports are 2,100 transports. Right?
Yep.
So that would be a C, D, or E.
You know, transport can be an A. An A column can be a transport also.
An A, well, we're playing Monopoly here now. So A can be a transport.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay, so the question comes in with that then. What percentage ends up in a transport out of the 4,200? How many of those get, as long as we're talking about it? Way more than I imagine you thought we were going to talk about this.
Okay.
Surprise.
That's funny.
Well, on page 11.
Yeah. Well, it's okay.
So medical runs, you know, just calls up, that are EMS related. Yeah, Ashland had 2,800. And out of those, transported 2,000.
Okay.
So whatever that.
And that brought in that much money. 2,000.
But now the 28, just because we were talking about something a little different just a moment ago, I thought.
I think Sean was up in that 4,000 range. And that's
right.
Our total call volume.
Right.
So that includes all of our fire calls.
But we respond to four.
We respond to all of those calls.
4,165, right?
Correct.
Okay. And then when he said, well, then it's just the C&D that we're transporting, I thought you corrected him and said, no, some of the A's and the B's would end up by being transported, right?
Right.
Okay, so the 2,800, I'm being slow here today, but the 2,800 that are transported,
2,000
out of the 2,800 that
correct.
Are transported. I thought the 2,800 represented C and D calls.
No, 2,800 is A, B, C's, D's, and E's.
1,600 was C and D, I think.
1,600 was C and D?
Yeah, that's what I read.
Okay, so that's what I was doing a while ago. I turned those two numbers upside down. So C's and D's are 1,600. And so you have about 400 out of the A and B group that you transport. Something like that. Just trying to get a handle for...
Let's say, all right, 2,000 transports.
Right.
Keep it simple. It was 2012. And I think we said roughly 50% of our calls are non-emergent.
Okay.
All right. Let's just go with 50%. Mm-hmm. Okay, Sean?
Perfect.
Right. So 50% are non-emergent. Non-emergents are definitely A's and some B's.
Right.
So it depends, you know, if we're going to say 50%, I'd say 1,000 of our transports are those
okay.
A and B type
I see
calls,
what you're doing.
And okay. the other 1,000 are C's, D's, and E's.
2,000 transports. Tell me again that figure you said. The income was a million something? Or 2,000?
1.1 million.
Say that again.
A little over $1 million.
Yes, about 1.1 million.
Seems like a lot of money for 2,000 transports.
Yeah. Chief, can I ask you a numbers question?
Yes, sir.
So, if there's 4,167 calls that you respond to, right?
Yep.
And the last meeting, I asked both those chiefs if by not responding to AB calls, was that a significant help or did that have a significant impact on their budget? And they both said yes. They didn't, and then we kind of danced around, give me a number, and he said roughly, I think they said roughly $870-ish mm-hmm. per call, right? So I looked at your data on page 14, and it said that each call was $830 for the department to go out. So if that's 4,000 calls and it's 800, that's roughly $3.2 million in cost. that you're responding to, if you cut that in half, which is essentially what you're talking about, you're saving $1.6 million by not responding to the AB.
But you don't currently respond to this.
Well, the more important issue with that...
Does that make sense? Am I wrong?
It doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
I'll tell you why it doesn't make sense. Variable and fixed costs. You're just... Because we have to staff... it kind of comes back to that, talking about the utilization, how often do you have a patient in the back of your ambulance? How often, are you always busy? Do you have vehicles on the road that never come back to the station?
Yeah.
Right? If we were a private ambulance service and my goal was to be profitable, my ambulance would always have somebody in the back of the ambulance. I would always have a patient in the back of my ambulance, always transporting somebody to the hospital, always busy. Because if I have a unit sitting, then I'm not making money. Okay? And I think, your example, just by taking a number for the dispatch, you have to understand that as a fire department, we have to be ready for a response, which means I'm not always out on the road responding to the call. I don't always have a patient in the back of my ambulance.
Yeah.
I have to have firefighters who are also paramedics who are here to handle the moderate risk structure fire. And that comes with a cost.
Yeah.
So if you just say, well, let's just eliminate those amount of calls and then you can reduce your budget by X amount of dollars. That's not apples
okay,
to apples.
Okay, no, fair enough. But we're talking about there's revenues here of $1 million, right?
Yes.
But there's a cost element to it as well. And I'm trying to understand what that cost is. So if it's $800, let's call it, and there's 4,000 calls that we're responding to, right? Then that is a charge of $3.2 million, just by looking at the numbers. Everything else aside, fair?
I'd have to see the paper.
Well, 4,000 times 800.
Okay.
$3.2 million.
Shane, and I get where you're trying to go. Shane just said something that's important here, which is you'd have to be able to separate out fixed costs and variable costs.
Yeah.
And there'd be a variable
cost. I'm not disagreeing with that. No,
right. Yeah. But there'd be a variable cost component. But that is something that we should try to get our hands on, is what is the variable cost component? Because now, as soon as I say that, there is a certain degree of fixed cost that obviously you can also... get away from if you went a different direction. So it would be the package of how much fixed costs are avoidable along with how many variable costs are avoidable. And that's one of the numbers that we are still sort of searching for.
Okay.
Yeah.
Is what is it that you can impact in a decision like this.
Right. I just wanted to be clear. I'm just trying to understand. I'm trying to peg a number so I can compare it to a revenue number.
You're actually being quite helpful.
And I get the fixed cost, the variable cost. That's going to change depending on A through Z. I'm just saying, what are the numbers that we can compare? And that's the basis of my question. So.
Okay.
That's a good basis.
Yeah.
I like it. Yes.
One more quick question, because this is really interesting to me. You're going to answer everything. Whether you have the ambulance service or not, you're going to go to every call.
Correct.
Is that what the industry does? Is that what the other fire departments who were here and spoke before and said they no longer go to the ones and the do they go to every call, or is this something our fire department has chosen to do?
What I heard from Chief Orton, Chief Fish, with the Medford Fire. Medford Fire doesn't go to every call. Those low acuity medical calls, they weren't responding to.
Okay.
However, Chief Horton, and I know Chief Hanley with District 5, which are our fire district, Jackson County Fire District 5, Jackson County Fire District 3, they both have internal policies where they respond to every call. So it's something where their governing body, their board of directors has directed them to respond to all emergencies that originate in their area. And that's something that is a policy decision.
Okay, so this is one of the decisions that perhaps would be something to
make a recommendation.
Put in the pot.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it won't be, it'll be something you will be instructed to do differently,
right,
or the same.
Yeah, and it, you know, and that would be depending on, you know, at some point in time we would have that discussion. And it would be something where I would have to come back and inform you of what the risk is of not responding to those,
right,
calls. So you would, you know, you would need to understand that way in case what your decision
is. Risk being mainly time.
What's that?
Risk being primarily the time of getting there. Is that what you would think?
Yeah, time would be a factor, especially if only the ambulance is responding to the scene. You know, there could be some other factors that we need to look at.
But I mean, if you didn't respond at all, if you did what Medford, I guess, did,
yeah,
don't respond to those, then that risk in your mind would be the time it would take to get there.
There's time, but there could be other factors. Like, what happens if, one of the chiefs was talking about this, like, when people call in to 911 in an emergency, they don't always give accurate information. And so if they're just painting this picture that, hey, everything's hunky-dory, there's not really much going on at my house, but really, there's disaster, you know, people are dying. And it's just that who's ever phoning that call in, they're not giving the proper information, and the fire engine with the extra crew doesn't respond. Did somehow, you know, what is that person going to do then later on? They say, how come the fire department didn't come to mind? You know,
if we ever talk about it,
I think one of the great things, we have Medford. We have an example that we can use. We can say, what kind of issues have you run into by not responding to these calls?
Yeah.
It'll be a good source for us.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Chief.
Thank you, Chief.
Thank you very much. You've working been very patient with us.
Working overtime. Where would you like to take us next?
You know, I think with Central Services, I think that given that we have about 40 minutes, I think I would like to go to, if you don't have any questions on Central Services or any, and we want to talk in depth about that, I think the information that Bryn has put together, I think I'd like to go over, because I think that's going to be a start of another good piece of dialogue, which is this, which is showing you the numbers in the general fund of things that I would, that the council has determined to be value services, and sort of what we spend on those. So,
can I ask a dumb question, and I should know the answer to this? Okay. So when you say Central Services, okay, very briefly, tell me the department. I know you're talking about all the departments, but is it a specific, is it more of a weight, let's say, in admin, HR, IT, than, or is it an equal?
In terms of dollars?
Yes. Or is it the determination of the funding based on the size of the department? Does that make sense?
Yes,
yeah.
And I would say the determination of funding, the amount that goes,
right,
is based on the personnel and the operations of that department.
The operations of the department.
So, for example, finance or administrative services is a central service function.
Right.
We have people who do payroll and accounts payable and accounts receivable and all, and we have accountants and they do what accountants do. And that is a department that has a set amount of people, and how that those people are funded is based on the central service methodology that was developed last year on how departments will pay. So for example, with payroll, payroll in finance is paid for by paychecks.
Basically, so, a modified activity-based costing.
Yeah.
How much you use,
Okay, so that's how it's
extent, based. Yeah.
Right, and that's how it's controlled. HR is like
it's an overhead. It's an overhead loading.
So was that a stupid question, or was that
no,
okay?
No,
okay.
I think that's a great question.
All right, I felt that.
That's exactly the question.
Yeah.
Okay, great. Thank you.
And just, Sean, just so you know, we talked about this, and I think this is an important factor, too. We did a new methodology for our central services and how they're paid for. Because we had an old model, but we kind of used it loosely. And we developed a model, and it's very similar to, I think, other cities and counties' models of how things are paid for. Like I said, payroll by number of employees, basically, paychecks. When we did that, what we realized, and we had known this before, is that our central service model had been more based on ability to pay and not necessarily strict methodology. And so when we looked at this new methodology, we did not feel comfortable fully rolling it out because it was going to be complete sticker shock to some departments,
yeah.
and not as much money coming okay. from others. And so we're rolling that out over 6 years. So just so you know, in terms of
perfect,
how
that's exactly where I was going.
You know,
yeah. Thank you.
Yeah, that's a good question.
All right,
Bryn, would you like to take it from there?
Yes. Oh, you ready?
Sure.
All right.
Okay. So you all have. Look at it up there or not, but you all have the worksheets. This is all general fund, and the top portion are the expenditures that we were asked to look at, and then the bottom portion we can go over, that's a little bit of the revenue. So when looking at some, if you want to call them non-essential services, these are some of the items we were asked to look into here. So public art program, this is their expenditures, and then on the very far right is the funding source. And that follows down RBTV, that's our filming of the council meetings. I'm not sure what else are
and planning commission.
Is that in planning commission, those meetings that are being televised, and how it's paid for. Tourism, that's the restricted portion. So the transient occupancy tax by state law, we have to dedicate and restrict a portion to tourism. And we accomplish that by a portion to our economic, cultural, tourism, sustainability, the many other things that are there, those grants. And then also towards other city tourism capital projects that are eligible. Whether it's very restrictive.
That's the grant process, right?
Well, the capital projects is different.
Okay.
But it's very restricted on what you can use it for. It has to meet a certain criteria.
How much of that is the capital?
So, on the bottom here.
Okay. Oh, I see.
It's
okay.
The breakout.
Okay.
So I'm sorry if we kind of jumped around here. But the tourism restricted, so if we start with, let's just start with what we budgeted for the biennium. $6.5 million. Almost 1.9 of that is tourism restricted. And then the remainder, 4.6, is general government operations.
Oh, got it.
That's down in the below that.
Yep.
So then, of that 1.9, there is the breakout of how we meet that tourism-restricted requirement. So, over the biennium, 892,000 roughly to the Visitor Convention Bureau Chamber, 220,000 to OSF. We've got some money in there for parking. The economic and cultural sustainability grants, $80,000 per year was approved so far. So that's 160. Public art, 42,000. And then the remainder would then go, so that's just the mathematical equation. The remainder of that is the other city tourism eligible capital projects.
So back up to the expenditures. Parking, there's the expenditure for parking. However, our parking fees cover the expense.
Back up to that.
Yes.
Friend, long-term parking, $491,454 was what was budgeted.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've got parking fees of $340.
So $491,454, that is the tourism portion of the revenue that's dedicated to the long-term parking. So, for example, we may over the years dedicate revenue to long-term parking where we haven't used it and it's compiling, it's restricted. And then now we have the downtown feasibility study. We have downtown parking. I'm not sure what the correct names of the committees and all of that is, but they're looking into ways to use some of those funds. But this parking expenditure up top is just our Diamond parking contract. It's our parking enforcement.
The $340?
Yes.
Parking fees cover expense.
So
do you have the parking fees down in income anywhere?
No.
So this really isn't an expense.
No. And that's what we're saying is it's neutral, but
the 491 is a pool of money.
Yes.
Goes into a pool of money that is sitting there yet to be decided upon for use.
Is
there are two
it
different
open-ended
pots.
Open-ended yet to be?
Well, is it restricted? It is part of the restricted TOT.
Mm-hmm.
It is not necessarily restricted to parking. Is that correct?
By your council resolution.
By council, but I mean it is restricted because we decide it's restricted to parking.
Yes.
It's been a policy decision.
Changed.
It can be changed.
Yes.
It could be used
for.
It still has to be used for tourism.
But it has to be used for tourism, so we can't just use it anywhere in the general fund.
No.
Well, and I think the rationale for the city council allocating money to parking in a basically an accruing savings account, if you will,
right,
is because people talk about a parking structure, people talk about parking is not cheap. And so it's, you know, having $200,000 isn't going to do a lot for parking downtown. So that's why, and if you looked at it over, you know, a period of time into the future, we're going to be looking at saving money to try to do something significant about parking. And that was the idea, I think, by the council in allocating those funds for that.
Isn't there another fund that goes into parking also that's generated by businesses downtown or construction?
There used to be a surcharge, I believe, on the citation. I don't know. I believe that went away.
So that funding went somewhere else or something.
So the question that goes with this right now is how big is the parking fund?
As part of the financial report, the quarterly financial report, it's part of that. It's on one of those pages, and we can show that for you.
No, I can look if it's on the...
Landscape orientation is the only restricted
one. Quick question. Citation. That kind of rings a bell with, just remember through the whole budgeting thing, that the ticket price went from $11 to $22, right? So if you get a ticket. So where does that money flow? Doesn't that flow into the general fund?
Yes.
Where is that?
And that's what Roberta was asking.
Oh.
I don't have parking revenue.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
I got you. I'm sorry. I thought you were talking about long-term parking. She was. She was
talking about the ticket on citation.
Yeah, citation fees.
Okay.
Where is that $491,002?
No.
How much is that?
So that's what we don't have.
Oh, okay.
So we'll get that for you.
Okay, Mark, what was it? Do you remember?
Let me check my handy website. I'll look.
No, I'm just figured you'd know that.
Okay. Back to you, Brent.
Continuing to go down just the line, we showed you what the property tax contribution is. It's been asked, and you folks have received the AFR reconciliation, and then we also included the CERT reconciliation of the program history. Okay. These are just the expenditures here, but on your reconciliation, you can see the detail. The social service grants, the expenditure for the social service grants, that's just straight out of the general fund. And then it was also asked the code enforcement, FTE.
And that's just the personal services. That's just the person.
And then band is not on the list of essential services, however, it's required in the charter. Just so for your information, it's listed there as well. And then the marijuana revenue below, that was requested.
Do you see that changing? Do you feel what's happening with the marijuana revenue? Anything?
I don't know. I don't know.
Still an unknown.
Yeah. I don't know. We're seeing, you know, that's a good hope that we get the 440, but we don't know. We don't see their sales, so we don't really know.
We don't know if it's a growing business or it's a business.
I keep asking this question. In these shops that are selling marijuana, and they have cookies and stuff, are we hitting them with a prepared food and beverage tax?
I don't think so. I don't think it's prepared on site, packaged. It's just kind of like a grocery store. Parking fines, $413,000 was collected in parking.
Thank you. I was hoping for that prepared food and beverage tax. I mean, the munchies ought to be able to.
It might be just sparkling.
Huh?
Yeah.
Oh, it's medicinal?
It's a lot. It's CBD. It's probably medicinal.
I want to tax them twice.
So in terms of code enforcement personnel and fines, do the fines pay for the code enforcement person?
No. And no code enforcement program pays for itself. You would not want that to happen because
it would be a lot of tickets.
And so usually it's between 5% and 15%. I mean, it's very low. It's not close to 50. It's not.
Code enforcement is cease and desist. I mean, it's more of a. Stop doing this and we won't find you, and you hope that people do so, right?
Right. It's really, I mean, code enforcement really is striving for voluntary compliance. And so the message to our code enforcement officer is we're trying to get voluntary compliance first, and voluntary compliance doesn't bring any dollars. You know, so it is not a money maker.
So is code enforcement what Chief was referring to before?
This is out of ComDev. This is more of a
Airbnb, building code.
Airbnb signage.
Okay.
It's like everybody on Brown Street got a letter saying you got to repair your sidewalks. If you don't, the city's going to come in and repair your sidewalks. So we all had to repair our sidewalks. It's that kind of thing.
Or like cut your tree back from you.
Right.
Yeah, cut your tree back.
Or, you know, someone has an Airbnb that's not, you know, registered. Or there are a variety of things. But mainly it's not criminal.
Okay. When I look at forestry, Chris Chambers comes to my mind. Is that Chris Chambers? Is that? Yeah, okay.
It's not all Chris Chambers.
Right.
No, it's not making $2.5 million.
Yeah. I was like, I like Chris Chambers a lot.
But, you know, we can talk a little bit about those things in terms of looking at when the council looked at essential versus value services, and the question came up, well, let's look at CERB, let's look at AFR. And so, you know, you can see with AFR, the program kind of ebbed and flowed in terms of general fund subsidy of that program, if you will. And it was, you know, it was up around 100,000. Sometimes it was, you know, for almost 500,000 that the general fund subsidized the program. But then what you see is in 2015-16, there was a shift in funding for the program because it felt that there was a nexus between the health of the watershed, where we get our water, and forest and the forest health and maintain and our forest resiliency. So what was happening then was $250,000 was coming out of the water fund into this program to help pay for it. And then what happened is that at this last biennium we increased the AFR fee.
Right.
To $3 total. And what that did was and Mark was here. Mark had meetings with Chief Durazzi and Chris Chambers. And what that did was it increased revenue to pay for, to increase the money going into that program so that the water fund, which was pays a franchise, and part of that franchise has gone into this program, that money for that franchise from the water fund is going mainly into the general fund. And that $3 now is helping support this program without that money from the water fund. So it didn't mean, it didn't mean that this program was going to have $1.67 per user, per month, per year, more money to do more things. It meant that this program was staying whole. We weren't cutting this program, and that money, that franchise fee portion of the franchise fee that comes in from the water fund, which every enterprise fund pays a franchise fee to the city, just like Avista does. So it's similar to a privately held utility. That money went into the general fund.
So, but we're still at about $250,000 is what is our impact. We're not paying $3.7 million. Or are we? Am I misunderstanding?
Where are you?
I'm at Forest Street.
That's 4.7.
3.7. 2017-19 actual was 3.7.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
$3.8 million, $3.7 million,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
That's, most of that is grant money that
right.
comes through.
Oh,
just
right.
I mean, so as people are looking at these numbers,
yeah.
they look, when you're talking and the fee, we're contributing, we started off with, if I remember correctly, about $150,000, and now it's gone to about $250,000, $300,000 is what we are contributing to the work that's being done in AFR. Is that not correct? Something along that? So what number are we being impacted?
Who's we?
We.
The general fund?
Us.
It's in the green box on this,
yeah.
I believe.
I'm not looking at that.
Okay.
Okay, so I'm looking at this $3.7 million.
That's the 17-19 actual, yeah?
Yeah, 17-19 actual. I don't. I got to stay in one place. 17-19 actual is for under forestry.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
Just for that time period,
yes.
That'd be that -$2,685 plus the -$179. So it's $181,000.
Okay, you're back over
here. Just for that time period. 18 actual, 19 actual.
I thought we were working off a general fund.
Yeah, I think it went from about 180K per biennium down
right.
to a wash.
Right.
The general fund contributions.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's not a wash. We're still taxing people. But I have a document here.
Yes.
This one here that says general fund. That shows for forestry $3.7 million.
Yes. The expense.
Right. Mm-hmm. That's the expense. Mm-hmm. And we cover, but we cover about $300,000 of that expense. Or do we cover it all? When I say we, our taxes, general fund money, the rest of it's by way of grant money. Is that not true?
Well,
what am I not communicating here?
There was about a half a million in transfer from the water
right.
fund, and then what, 375, 350 from the surcharge.
What I'm trying to get to is, what am I doing wrong here?
Local money.
Local money.
850K, I think.
850. Yeah. That's the number I'm trying to get to. The money that comes from our relationship with Ron Wyden or Merkley or whatever they're putting into the thing, the federal dollars is what helps fund this program. Yes. Right? Mm-hmm. The difference between $3.7 million and our impact to our taxpayers directly is about, has grown to 800,000? Is that what it is? Okay. That's what I'm looking for.
How does that transfer
2.7
into this report?
Mm-hmm. You would take.
Where does it fall in here?
You would take this number.
Yeah, I think he's looking at the transfer from water, which is local generated revenue.
Yeah. Well, I'm not looking
for and then the water surcharge.
Exactly. But his grants are $1.3 million.
No, but that's,
and then you
that's
can buy
got
those
the
2 years
grant
numbers.
Right. So you take, so it's that, it's $250,000, and then it's.
Right,
two,
okay.
$1.2 million.
Okay.
Right.
Or 170, like 175,000.
Twice. But actually, five is coming out of the water fund, so not coming out of general.
Not anymore.
Not anymore.
Because
that five is now being covered by the AFR fee.
Yes.
Okay.
Okay.
So before that, all used to come out of the unrestricted fund balance, tell me no, in the water fund?
No.
Good. Where'd it come from then?
The money that's coming in from the transfer from water?
Yeah.
It's part of their, it's coming from fees. Right? It's coming into the water fund.
It was that's the $1.67 you were talking about before, right? Or something like whatever. What was the fee
before? Part of water expenses is this contribution.
Yes.
Okay.
So therefore, it's in rates they're charged to customers.
And the rate, the AFR rate, is being run through that program now, or is that changed?
Well, so AFR has two fundings: local funding. You have the portion that the water is contributing, which is through rates. And then you have the AFR meter charge, which is a per meter.
So that still exists now. So when water rates go up, part of it's to do this. No. Okay.
Well, not as much.
But rates didn't go down when this 500 stopped.
No, because what's going to happen? No, they didn't.
No, they just get to keep the money. They don't have an expense line or a transfer line.
No, that $250,000 still comes into the general fund. So what happened before was that the general. So let me see. Look, Mark, correct me if I'm wrong. But basically, water pays a franchise fee to the general.
Okay.
To the city, just like a business.
Of how much? Is that the $250 or what?
No.
No,
more than $250.
8%.
Yeah.
Okay.
My memory's not very good.
I think it is 8%. I don't know what that equals. But we can get that for you. And maybe if we got that for you, I could show you kind of a diagram of kind of what happens. So it's a franchise fee that comes into the general fund. And of that, during 17-18 and 18-19, $250,000 of that came into the general fund was allocated for this program.
Okay.
What happened when we increased the water surcharge?
No, I'm.
It was that we increased it to an amount that could fund the program without that $250,000 being pulled off from the general fund franchise.
Okay.
And so it stays in the general fund.
Okay.
Yeah. And that total surcharge basically pays that $250,000 because it was about $220,000 we thought. So. So that's
so we are sort of cost neutral on the fee and what we're putting into AFR locally.
Yeah.
Basically, I mean, you're bringing that in. You're not adding anything to it. It is whatever comes in goes into AFR.
Yeah. Okay.
Thank you for your indulgence. That's kind of why we have to have this. Are you
getting ready? Go.
You gotta go.
I think
we all gotta go.
can I just throw one thing on the table? Looking at charter changes, there's the next item on this general fund is the van.
Yeah.
$32,000. Is it worth exploring the other mandated charter items which cost the general fund quite a bit of money to include the van? The elected city recorder, as well as the city municipal board.
Yeah, we'll get a taste for how people like charter amendments.
Yeah, we will.
In May.
And then, I just want to throw that out there. No, there is money.
I mean, I think it's something to talk about, but this town has been very conservative for a progressive town in changing charters. And so we're going to see what they think of the city manager, and that's going to give us some insight into your discussion. It's a good question, though.
Nice
Huberta,
see you.
Happy hockey practice.
Just one other thought that's rattling around in my head, and that is in our very first meeting, we had two presentations, one for PERS and one for health insurance. And we haven't really talked about that.
Right.
The first one, I think, was pretty much, it's dreadful, but it's nothing we can get our arms around that much. But the health insurance one, you gave us a presentation of, as I understood it, an agreement currently made with the employees,
mm-hmm.
and that is currently already approved, I guess, and in place.
Yes.
And we haven't said whether, because we are going to even go the route of more employee payment of a share of the health insurance in the future. Because what was presented then was, yes, it goes up a little, but it really doesn't impact the cost of the city.
No, in fact, we are saving money.
If we don't make people whole, or if we make people whole, that's the trick, right?
Yeah, right. No, I'm not talking about making people whole. That's the thing that are we going to adopt the making people whole philosophy as a committee? And if we are, that's fine. Or to me, it was if our charge is to cut costs, and this is the way to cut a cost. The way you would do it with this is if you're cutting that cost, you either cut employees, or the employees' take-home pay is less. You don't make them whole. If you make them whole, you go, that's no gain. I just wonder, are we walking away from this?
Can we get clarity on making people whole? I don't know what that means.
It means, I think, paying.
They don't feel it. Their net pay comes out the same.
If right. Make them pay,
so they come up, their salary's raised.
Right.
And that causes PERS, payroll taxes, blah, blah, blah. It causes all these other things.
Right. I think the answer to your question is, when we get to where we're considering recommendations, that's one of the things that we put on the table. I think we have to circle back to all those.
Yeah, I would hope so, because I want to.
Oh, absolutely.
Get my fingers.
You weren't here for that, so we need to be able to do that with you here.
No, because I think even things have changed in the last 9 months regarding how we pay people.
Right.
Right.
Aren't we rescheduling or re-look? I know during the budget process we talked about that, and I think we said, no, we don't want to talk about it now because we're going to look at it 2020 in January.
Well, that's what we're doing.
Okay.
We are going to do that. What we are in the process of finishing up next will be ComDev.
Yep. Yeah.
And then ComDev is the last piece that we'll hear from, pull apart, and then from there we'll start talking about what recommendations we want to make. So then we do have to talk about medical costs, we do have to talk about PERS, if there's any wiggle room there. Whatever is within that is when we start putting the recommendations together.
Can I throw something out like Roberta? When we talk about central service funds, mm-hmm. I want to know, is there anything in here, if we're talking about cost cuts, that we can outsource, that we can look at and say, for example, you know, information technology is such a crazy, difficult, you know, dragon, because it changes, it's constantly changing. So does it make more sense to outsource that relative to having it in-house? I don't know the answer to that, mm-hmm. but, you know, I just know in my old profession, you know, HR, legal, these were discussions that, you know, the management teams were having, you know, around the region, like, you know, does it make sense? And they didn't make any decisions when I was there, but we were talking about it.
Right.
And I think if we're going to have this broad discussion about how we cut costs, we need to talk about the elephant in the room, and that's healthcare, that's personnel, that's streamlining management, you know, and outsourcing. I mean, I did mention it during the budget process, and I, you know, some people weren't all that happy, but I wanted to say it because I thought it was essential that we'd have these discussions. And I just think if we're going to go there, we should at least talk about it.
Well, I think we plan on talking about it. I mean, because those are the kind of things that we're putting under study.
Right.
So,
well, terrific. It's great.
It's that dynamic between outsourcing, services, costs, and we need to take a look at this. It's also that can we economize that dynamic that I keep talking about. Either we can plan it or it's going to be foisted upon you.
Exactly.
It's either going to be, you're going to be at some point forced by market conditions of some kind to do this in a way that you don't want to do it if you don't plan before you get there. So that's what we're doing. So.
And can I add just to that? That's never a pleasant experience.
No.
Oh, no.
That always ends in tears.
Yeah.
Right.
It always ends dreadfully. No.
Right. It's tough.
So. Well, but, and I think that I think you're right. I think if we're gonna do that, then nothing is a sacred cow.
No.
So when we talk about those things and we talk about this list of things, none of these are sacred cows either. And I will tell you, just so you know, I didn't put the three firefighters on here as non-essential or as value services, because when we brought those to the budget committee, the three firefighters, and we said, we cut the three firefighters and we're going to have to do these other things, I never characterized them as value service. I characterized them as an essential service. The issue, it wasn't whether they were essential or not, the issue is that they were hired with no commensurate revenue attached to them. And so, or there was a thought that there was going to be, and that didn't come to fruition, I think is really in fairness to the council. I think the council thought there was going to be revenue there, and there wasn't. So, so no, I think that's fine. So I would ask that you think about this list, because it's an interesting list,
good list
of things that we do that the council considered value services. Mm. I think this is valuable information in terms of how we're trying to structure AFR, but it does give you an idea that, you know, the general fund is basically, over the course of AFR, subsidized that program about $2 million. That's all water under the bridge. I think we're moving forward in a positive way with that program, but just to let you know. And then with CERT, because CERT was brought up as well, to CERT is a general fund proposition, what this shows you is what, if you were looking at the service of CERT, how much it costs from the general fund's perspective. And so this is another piece. that you might want to look at.
So
what happened to CERT grants? Oh, sorry.
What happened to, I'm sorry.
The CERT grants, like there were no grants in 19, but there were, they used to get some grants.
I was under the impression, being way back in the day when CERT was first done, that it had become pretty much a property owner collaboration, where the property owner would pay for the service and with the oversight of the CERT. But is that not happening?
It's a program where, you know, we attract volunteers and we train them on emergency response.
Oh, it's that.
It's that.
Isn't there 300-something volunteers or something for the CERT?
It's
like,
like, if you want to get hate mail, get rid of the band and get rid of CERT, right? We've got to blame Mark.
As a matter of fact, tomorrow night, every seat will be filled tomorrow night, and they'll be waiting for us in the next council meeting when they hear that it was even... No, I'm just kidding. But, I mean, I've been here when we talked about CERT.
Yeah. What about FireWise? I guess that's what I'm
They get grants.
About.
FireWise gets grants.
FireWise gets grants.
It's FireWise.
So
we can look at that, too. FireWise is a program within...
Yeah,
it's Katie's program. Right. And I think it's funded through... We can look at that, though. Grant funding, primarily, and...
So, like Kelly, one of the things about AFR, years ago, grants weren't going to happen unless we put money into it. We had to have some skin in the game or we weren't getting grants. And I remember that was a big discussion of
I think it still exists.
A couple hundred thousand. So that's something that is tied to the grants very closely.
Right, and I think that's why that original surcharge was enacted to do to raise that money. And you're right. What we are finding, and this is, I think, going to be the case moving forward, is that to get money from the Fed to the state, we have got to have some significant skin in the game. Communities that have more skin in the game are the communities that succeed more with grant funding. And so you're right. We need, and I don't think what we did with the increasing the fee last year is going to change any of that. We have money for staff, we have money for in-kind, we have money to put up that we're actually doing some work ourselves, and I think we'll be okay. But if we weren't, and that would make us uncompetitive, I would want to come and talk to you all.
I'd like to thank you both. I know it's not easy. You've got a bunch of people that don't do this on an everyday basis. And so you have to educate us each step along the way, and you're doing a wonderful job of that. I think it's been a very nice, very good discussion. Thank you to the crowd. Although I didn't hear a whole lot of applause. Chief, thank you for coming. You all have a happy holidays. Thank you for your work, and we'll see you in the new year.
Shalom.
Well, the combat one, because I have permits in for combat, and to basically make our house ADA compatible, the street SDC is $700,000. No more bedrooms, no more nothing. Just making.